Hello, welcome to the New Stack Makers, a podcast where we talk about at-scale application development, deployment, and management.
VMware software powers today's complex digital infrastructures. Their cloud, networking and security, and digital workspace offerings provide dynamic and efficient solutions to over 500,000 global customers. VMware is committed to being a force for good, from its breakthrough innovations to its global impact.
It's so good to be back for another pancake breakfast with our friends from VMware and some other experts who are here. Hi, I'm Alex Williams, founder of the New Stack. We're here for some pancakes, and I brought my pancakes. I just wanted to see if anyone, has anything to share with me, but I brought pancakes with some nice peaches. And so we were playing a little President of the United States of America. Is that the band? Like peaches going out to the country. These are the last peaches, I think, of the season. Yeah, but everyone knows that song, right? Anyways, does anyone else have anything to share here? Is that syrup?
I've just got a spatula.
Okay, well, listen, I got mine. Can we just do a synchronized flip? Ready? 1, 2, 3. All right. And so, can someone pass the syrup if you have any syrup?
I've got whipped cream over here. That's
okay. That'll be good. Can you pass it up to Job?
So there you go. Okay. But the question I have, noticing that the New Stack intro spirals from the outside in.
Yeah.
So, because the whipped cream goes on the pancake, you can make a smiley face, but the spirals need to go too. Question for all of you, when you're putting whipped cream on your pancakes or syrup for that matter, do you spiral from the outside in or from the inside out?
Oh my
clockwise,
gosh.
Baby, clockwise.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so one clockwise.
Outside in, but I will say on a waffle. I'm team
on
waffle.
A waffle.
Don't like pancakes.
Team waffle. You got team waffle.
Sean, this
here.
Is not the last we're hearing about waffles.
No, I'm going to keep saying it until you guys know that I don't eat pancakes.
Do you put syrup and or whipped cream or berries?
No. Never syrup on a waffle.
Yes.
No.
What do you do with the waffle?
What's the point of a waffle if you're not going to make use of the isolated containers for your
syrup? Is
you're not having a container strategy, Sean.
I don't believe in syrup and I don't believe in pancakes. Sorry, folks.
Well, Sean, maybe next time you can bring the waffles and because the pancakes here at the New Stack are all about the love. We'll accept waffles any day.
All right. I'm glad that it's an inclusive culture, even though I'm anti-pancake.
Well, Domaine, it sounds like we're going to have to bring the syrup because I don't know what Sean does with his dry waffles, but they don't sound too appetizing.
Fine. Fruit is good, but syrup is just disgusting. It's horrible stuff.
So the syrup, some people just pour the syrup on, right? And they don't really drizzle it around. Or is there, Job, are you that kind? Or are you pretty particular about how your syrup is flowing on the pancake? Or you're not a syrup guy?
I'm pretty much a smear sort of person. I just smear it on there.
Yeah. Well, because it's if you douse it, then you get it saturated in one spot and it's not evenly distributed. It's, there needs to
That's one other reason, Dormain, that waffles are superior to pancakes.
Well,
it is. They don't absorb syrup like that.
When it comes to waffles and pancakes, there's... you can have your pancakes on premise or you can have your waffles off premise, right?
Yeah. You need just a cross breakfast good strategy so that you can plug into all of these breakfast foods.
Yeah.
I don't know. Keeps making me think about those horrible waffles that you get in those kind of cheaper hotels at the free breakfast. That's the off premises.
I think those were eliminated during the pandemic, so we don't have to worry about those anymore.
Domaine, that could be a new strategy to market PaaS. Tell people it's pancake as a service.
Oh, love it.
Yep. Stack them up.
Yeah. Keep them coming. on demand.
Well, let's keep it coming, you know, for the show here. I want to welcome everyone who's listening in, everyone who's out there. We are accepting your questions, and we actually are going to talk about other topics besides pancakes, but let's focus then on what I was thinking about, what we're going to really talk about. We had a very animated discussion the other day, and we were talking all about multi-cloud and all its dimensions and everything else. And, you know, and what I wanted to get this discussion going in terms of thinking about business innovation, because a lot of what I'm hearing from the VMware World event is about innovation, and it is about all those things that you do need to do. But when we're talking about innovation at the NewStack, what we see a lot is the focus on open source. And so my question really is about, how does business innovation speed up if companies know so little about open source and what it takes really to build out that declarative infrastructure, which we hear so much about? And, you know, I wanted to go right to Dormaine because I know Dormaine, you know, had some pretty interesting perspectives about this. I'd love to hear it. And then from anyone else there.
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, you have to kind of look at the question about innovation first and make sure you're not tightly coupling that to declarative systems or open source or really any like technology, because fundamentally, when you think about innovation, what promotes that, you have to put psychological safety in the conversation. And a lot of that comes down to, have you created an environment where folks can fail in as they're trying things, right? If that is not possible, it's really hard to cultivate innovation, regardless of technology. And so that's something that, just before you get into any of the technology choices that people are making, if you want to think about innovation, you got to solve for that first from a cultural perspective. But where open source can really fit into the picture is, you know, when you talk about speed, right, and speeding up innovation. And then, okay, let's say you've solved for that cultural phenomenon where folks are allowed to experiment. You know, start small, try something out, see if it works. Know that, you know, it's gonna fail 9 times out of 10. But as they keep iterating, how do they have quick and easy access to tools that they need to keep trying that next thing? And if there's a lot of friction in that system, then that will slow things down. And so a lot of the reason why open source is so popular is that it provides that frictionless access. Now, there's other ways to solve for that. It's just open source happens to do that really well. And that kind of really helps promote continuous experimentation, and therefore that's how you're going to have those innovative breakthroughs. Because I think there's plenty of innovation that happens that has nothing to do with open source, but you're just talking about, how do you let people quickly experiment and try things out? I don't know if Mandy or Joe or Sean disagree or not, though.
Before we go there, I do want to introduce everyone, because I did fail to do that. We were talking so much about pancakes. And so you just heard from Jermaine Druitz, who's a senior director of product marketing for VMware Tanzu, Mandy Sturbachen, a cloud technologist for VMware, Sean Bass, CTO for VMware's end user company computing business, and Joe Peterson, vice president cloud and security services at Clarify 360. And I wanted to then turn this to maybe to Mandy, who could then give us some of her thoughts and insights about this, because I know, Mandy, you deal with customers who have longstanding infrastructure, and they're trying to innovate as much as anyone.
Yeah, I completely agree with Dormaine, and it's not necessarily technical capabilities that drive innovation. It is definitely a cultural thing. And so there are different ways to approach that. And so there was like three different parts to your question. You know, there's a discussion around open source, and especially in the enterprises, which we usually work with, where open source software fits. And like Domain said, it's a matter there of getting capabilities into the hands of people that are trying new things very quickly without having to go through a huge buying cycle or, you know, buy enterprise software before they can even try something out. And then, you know, there's the declarative infrastructure or any kind of infrastructure as code, even if it's imperative. The thing there is about getting the resources into the hands of the folks that need it as quickly and as friction-free as possible also. But really the innovation comes from, like Domain said, giving people permission to try new things. And so there's some of that will just come naturally through the culture of the organization and the team. And then some of it can be a little, you know, forced or, you know, Google, for example, has that 20% rule, 20% of your time you can spend on new projects, which may not bear fruit immediately, but maybe will sometime in the future. And then some people have said, well, actually that's the 120% rule allows me to, you know, do all my work and then another 20%. And I actually had a manager that implemented that rule for our team, and he called it science projects. And to me, it was, you know, it's hit and miss. It was very much, oh, now I do 20% extra work that I don't actually get any credit for, but I loved doing, and so I did it anyway. So it really does come down to leadership and culture, and the tools and capabilities will be there and they need to be accessible, and the leadership needs to be supportive, and the tools and capabilities will change and evolve, but it has to be a culture. It has to be driven by the culture of the organization.
Yeah, and Alex, I'd just like to add an angle from the end user computing side of the world at VMware. You know, we don't deal with, you know, infrastructure and app dev and cloud and those types of things as much in terms of, you know, infrastructure or app deployment. But I think that the notion of things moving from imperative to declarative is actually happening all across our industry. So a lot of the tools that companies are using today to manage their distributed endpoints, whether it's laptops, desktops, mobile devices, whatever, most of those tools are imperative configuration management style tools. And there has been a shift happening over the last, I would say, probably 5 to 10 years for companies to start thinking of, you know, more desired state management. What is the configuration we want to deploy to a particular target, and let the capabilities on the endpoint automatically correct that device and bring it to that desired state management. So this notion of moving from imperative to declarative is also happening in the endpoint operating system world as well. In fact, many people that don't track the end user space may not know this, but Apple has actually begun implementing a declarative management model for iOS devices, starting with, you know, iPhone and iPad. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to be moving that into the Mac OS platform later. So even kind of the big three in the mobile desktop operating system world, they're making strides to get towards declarative management in each of their stacks as well. So we're seeing this everywhere, both server and app dev, as well as on the endpoint side.
I didn't realize that, Sean, so this is why I love having you on to kind of add that perspective. But I'm glad you brought up the declarative part of Alex's initial question, because I think that whole thinking about what is a declarative approach useful for, and for me, it comes back to scaling and resiliency. And when you're in those innovative stages, like, you're not really thinking about that. And that's probably not the right thing to be thinking of, is like day one, before we've solved anyone's problem, let's make sure that this thing is resilient and scales. It's like, but I haven't solved anything yet. So like, go make sure you're solving your customer's problem first, and then you come back and you figure out how you're going to scale it and make it resilient. And that absolutely is where that declarative approach comes in handy, and that has been the game changer in the last, whatever, 5 years or so, because that then allows you to kind of automate so much to just reconcile to that desired state that you talked about, Sean, and really like take the humans out of a lot of these processes and steps, whether it's round scaling or bringing something back online. And that is really what helps you kind of achieve those DevOps outcomes of how do we get higher quality code out faster and more frequently. And those tightening up those feedback loops, that then feeds back into those innovation cycles. When you do that, then your development teams are getting input and feedback on, oh, is that working, right? Did that solve the problem? Did that help our business in some way? As opposed to like, okay, I put something out there and now I'm going to wait like 6 months or 3 months or whatever it is. And, you know, think about like the last thing you did where it's like you wrote a memo or your presentation, like if you're not a coder, right? And then think about like if you put that out there and then like 3 months later, someone comes back and says, oh, I have some feedback for you. It's like, that's not useful. I can't even remember like where, what I had for breakfast this morning. I mean, obviously I had pancakes, but like, I can't remember like, what did I wear, you know, 2 days ago, like, let alone what was I thinking? Where was my head at when I built this thing or wrote this thing? Especially if it's like a fine little nuance in order to be able to actually go back and be like, okay, now I know how to fix it. So there is this connection, right? A declarative system, a declarative approach, when applied in order to be able to automate and go quickly, can feed into those innovation cycles by just closing that feedback loop timeline.
Mm. Just closing the loop.
It's about having, always having a known state, right? You always have a known state. And I have more and more customers, and I'm very much on the infrastructure side, that instead of patching systems and, you know, mutability is another concept that we use in kind of the same vein. But that known state is what's critical. So whether you are using declarative technology to bring it back to a known state or whether you are just rebuilding every time, it means that there's no configuration drift. The system's always in the application the way that you expect them to be. And that really cuts down on troubleshooting that we've all had our entire careers because something isn't quite in the state that you expected it to be. And you don't know how it got there, or you make a change and, you know, there's an unexpected, you know, outcome from it. It's really about always having that defined state.
Yeah, 100%.
Joe, I wanted to ask you a question about these companies out there that are really trying to figure out the value that they can provide. And how really the question is, how can you be in any position to provide any value if the organization is still relying on systems and services that are built on technologies really never meant for scale?
Right. So I like this question because it's reality. And there's so much to unpack with this question. It is so true that there is a correlation between this an organization's competitiveness and the development and operations flexibility that they have, right? So establishing an IT environment that works in lockstep with the business is key. But you get into a shop, and maybe you're the new director of IT ops, and you have legacy technology that you have to deal with. So you have to think about, how am I going to, you know, take what I have today? How am I going to continue to innovate with what I have today? And you end up in this situation where you're building net new in the cloud and you're caring for legacy systems. And what you really want is a bridge between the two. And what you really crave is this visibility and the ability to manage from end to end, because that's your world. You'd like something else maybe, but that's your world for whatever reason. Maybe it's a sunk cost. Maybe it's regulatory constraints. Maybe it's all that sort of thing happening to you. And so if you really want to get to the next phase, you have to have a strategy. And I'm going to say this, and it may be a little controversial, you have to have executive sponsorship, because you're not going to make it to the next level if you don't. And that's what I'd say.
You're not going to make it to the next level if you don't. When we're thinking about, you know, the next transitions that companies have to make, Mandy, then what is it that you need to be thinking about, you know, when you're beginning that process, so you don't get stuck with the legacy mindset?
In the keynote yesterday, I think, Domain, I don't remember what the statement was, but it was something today's, I don't know, innovation is tomorrow's tech debt. It was something like that you had said. And I've always said the same thing. As soon as something goes into production, it's now legacy, right? Because there are now restrictions and constraints around it that make it legacy in one way or another. And it's you know, it's kind of set in stone at that point to a certain extent. And so when we talk about legacy, really what we're talking about is everything that's in production. You know, I've worked on, I can't tell you how many mainframe migration projects over my early career, you know, 20 years ago that actually was still on the mainframe for these banking and airline applications, you know, and that's an exaggerated, you know, or a very common example. But I don't really like the concept of legacy. I like the, you know, the concept of your application portfolio. So there really becomes this, you know, like the multi-cloud thing that we started on with Joe, but also this app modernization. I saw a stat in, I think, one of the surveys that VMware did recently that 72% of businesses are focused on application modernization, and that could be refactoring or replatforming or whatever. But none of that is actually delivering business value in of itself, right? It's maybe getting the organization to a better position to be able to start to add additional business value through application, new functionality and features. But the modernization in itself is not doing that. And that's an awful lot of time spent by organizations just modernizing applications to the point where they can start to update them and build new capabilities. So I think that there's a lot still to learn, but we need to stop taking shortcuts and saying we'll worry about it in the future, because the future comes really, really quickly. And I think the biggest challenge to innovation is taking shortcuts today.
Yeah, Alex, I'll add a comment to that. And again, you know, application architectures and is not my forte, but I was a software developer before I got in consulting. And, you know, I will say sometimes people overthink or overcomplicate what needs to be done to deliver business value to a business's employees. So I guess my point is you don't need a microservices architecture, containerized platform, whatever, for every single application. There's nothing wrong with a monolithic app if it's something that can be cranked out quickly and provided to users and derive business value. Obviously, if you think the application is something that you're going to need to be able to scale out to multiple clouds and scale out to a huge number of users, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of users, then yes, you should be taking that approach in mind when you design the application. But every application doesn't need that type of scale and automation. And sometimes you end up pouring so much money into making something completely modern architecture, and the ROI or the value that you get out of that is just not worth what you put into it. So I'm not saying modern app architectures are bad. I know Domain's probably going to throw things at me and throw a pancake at me. I'm just saying that not every application has the requirements that dictate that type of an effort for the architecture of the app.
I'm going to like keep my pancakes to myself, Juan. Okay.
Because I wasted on him anyway.
Yeah, he's like, he's not going to eat them. So... Because I agree with you, and there's like a slightly different version, which is one, yeah, not everything needs to be a microservices architecture. Great series from my colleague Nate Chuda on, you know, does this need to be a microservice, and kind of walking through, it's like, does it need independent scalability? Does it need be able to iterate on its own? You know, like, if the answer is no, then like, don't do it. It's actually a more complicated architecture that introduces challenges. But there's another thing in terms of this, like, yes, how do we go about modernizing? Which is the other trap that I see is where folks really take the boil the ocean approach, and they think, okay, that's right. We need to modernize. We need to do it now. And so we're gonna roll in kind of like a process. We're gonna assess everything. We're gonna calibrate everything. We're gonna come up with work streams and approaches. And it's like an 18-month process before anyone even touches an application. And they've changed in that time, right? So to your point about you've just sunk a bunch of calories into a process and gotten nothing out of it. I mean, you didn't even write anything into microservices. You just took a bunch of time assessing. And so how do you actually come at that problem in a way where it's like, how do we just quickly scope things to get to the point where we've identified something that we're going to modernize, and whether or not it's going to go to a full-blown cloud-native architecture, or it's just like, you know what, this might be useful to containerize just so that we can start to, you know, move it around, put it on different systems, apply patches more easily, right? Just plug it into a few things. It doesn't need to be a microservice, but maybe it would benefit from a little bit of light refactoring. So how do you get to that point, right? Like, that's kind of the quick engagement style that certainly like my friends over at Tanzu Labs love to bring that approach. And so they've educated me on that. So don't boil the ocean is the other thing. The one place where I'd say it is useful to think about modernizing because of the whole today's fresh code is tomorrow's tech debt is the pile of vulnerabilities that you're sitting on in your tech debt, which may be as fresh as yesterday's fresh code, is astounding. And so thinking about how do we start to implement processes and systems that allow us to quickly roll out patches and mitigate vulnerabilities over a large code base, whether or not it's like, wow, this is a really business critical application that would really benefit from velocity, right? If we need velocity, then it's probably going to be worth the calories to refactor that. If this is like, this is just printing out like a basic label on things so that people can come into the building, that's probably not worth rewriting into microservices. But you may want to make sure that it's not vulnerable. And so how are you going to look at, okay, what's the bare minimum we need to do in order to make sure that we can start to apply these kind of like least privilege principles and apply patches without having to interrupt and make it a whole production. So I think that's the one place where I would challenge like myself on the whole thinking about don't boil the ocean, but do also think about security everywhere.
Do think about security everywhere. Now, I want to get back to that. But first, Joe, we do have a question. Do you want to pose what we're hearing from one of our listeners? I believe it's someone we know out there in the world.
Oh, yes, our research analyst, Lawrence Heck. He does have a question. We want to get into it. But first, let's level set and talk a bit about multi-cloud. Now, from the TNS newsroom, we've been covering the conference this week, and the big takeaway is that VMware wants to be your multi-cloud company. Let's find out a bit about what this means. When we're thinking about multi-cloud operations, what does this mean, and what can VMware bring to the table?
I mean, I'll just jump in there a little bit, because to me, like, multi-cloud is the mess we're living in. And a little bit to the point of what Sean was saying, where, you know, it's not always worth the investment. It's also like trying to define and spec out, like, this is our platonic ideal of the, you know, the infrastructure environment we want to be running in and the app, you know, it's like those types of dreams of the enterprise architect or the cloud architect may sound really good in paper, and then they're really hard to implement in reality because just things move too fast. There is, organizational drift, even if you can control the configuration drift. And so you end up living in a world of multi-cloud. And so how do you solve for that? As much as, you know, you might have the designs of like, well, everything would be perfect if we could just stay within these specifications, right? The same thing applies to your cloud infrastructure. It's just not going to stay that neat and tidy. So how are you solving for that reality?
So multi-cloud is kind of where I live. You know, been in the cloud management business unit for a couple of years. In fact, I have now just moved back out to the field. But like everything else in the world of cloud, terminology is really important, and we don't really have consistency in terminology across the board. And so some organizations, when they talk about multi-cloud or apps being multi-cloud, are about the same application being running in different clouds or being resilient across different clouds. But we look at it much more simply than that. The reality today of organizations using different types of clouds to deliver different types of services. And so when you look at it like that, every organization is multi-cloud. So whether it's because you are using SaaS solutions with Office 365, or you actually have infrastructure, cloud infrastructure across multiple clouds because you're using best of breed technology for one of the cloud providers, or you acquired a company that already had a footprint in one of the clouds, you are either already multi-cloud or you will be very shortly. And so when we as VMware look at multi-cloud, quite apart from having multi-cloud applications, having multi-cloud environments, it's really how do we help customers make sense of those disparate environments, those different tool sets, those different constructs, so that we can deliver some level of consistency to our innovators, the people that are writing the business logic that are going to support the business value. And so we do that in two different ways. One is delivering a consistent infrastructure platform through our virtualization technologies through the different cloud providers. So you've seen that at VMworld this week with Google and AliCloud and Azure and VMC on AWS, VMware Cloud on AWS, where you have our vSphere platform in those cloud providers so that you can have the agility and flexibility of the public cloud, but with the solutions that you already know and trust and you have trained your employees on and you understand those tool sets and skill sets. And then there's multi-cloud that is that extends further your governance and management layer across those native cloud services in those different environments too. And so when we talk about multi-cloud, that's really what we talk about, is bringing some kind of logical management and consistency across those disparate environments so that you can deliver better services to your internal business users.
Terrific, terrific. And so on to the question from Lawrence, what role does automation play in all this? How successful can you deploy code updates through multiple clouds with automation? Or what role does automation play here?
Yeah, and I think that's where you kind of have to decouple it. So on the underlying infrastructure layer, what Mandy laid out is how you have to think about, yes, we're going to be operating in and need to be able to manage a multi-cloud environment, right? And there's a ton of work going into that. When you think about, okay, now how are we solving for deploying code faster? You know, which is really one of those DevOps outcomes goals. Then yes, that is absolutely where you're that has nothing really to do with your infrastructure so much as thinking about how have you automated your processes to get from code to deployed in any infrastructure environment. And so, you know, there it's like, it's everything from, you know, your testing processes. Have you automated your tests? Do you have tests written for your code, right? So you can actually run integration tests. Can you run them quickly so that as developers are writing code and committing them up into Git repos, right, then you've got some way of kicking off a testing process that's going to make sure that this thing is actually going to behave the way you expect, right? And catch those bugs really quick, right? Those tight feedback loops. But then we all know that even if it's like, okay, it's passed functional tests, it's passed integration tests, now we have to actually land this in environment and move it through like from a staging environment into a prod environment. And we're going to have all these gates in the way, right? Whether they're security checks, we've got to scan this, we've got... So some of this is like, how can we shift as much of that left so that the components that developers are pulling in have already been scanned? But you're still going to have these checkpoints along the way. And so this is where that notion of what's your supply chain that's moving code along that journey to go from we've finished building the code, now we've tested it, now we're getting ready to deploy it. And so... That whole supply chain choreography is part of the Tanzu app platform that we've announced and announced the second phase of the beta here at VMworld. But then when you think about, okay, for a lot of new code, what we're doing is we're packaging that up in containers, we're landing it in a Kubernetes environment. Kubernetes becomes kind of this abstraction across clouds because... You know, if you're using a Kubernetes, like ideally, it's like, well, it should behave the same way. Now, you need to manage that environment. You need to manage your kind of multi-cloud Kubernetes if that's what you're dealing with. But at least there's like, well, there's some consistency there. We're going to build in the same way, and we should be able to deploy this into Kubernetes, whether it's running in our own data center, it's running on vSphere, or it's going to be running on EKS, or it's going to be running wherever. And so that's where you kind of get this marrying together of, how are we managing and operating in a multi-cloud environment? But then separately, we have to kind of solve at that platform layer for the developers may not care where the code is running. They care, like, are they getting those tight feedback loops? And do they have a streamlined path to production that they can plug into? And that's really what that platform, really it's a team and a system that they can build for those developers, and it can just abstract them away from whatever cloud they're running on.
Joe, I wanted to bring a question back to you about, you know, taking this back out a little bit and looking at the big picture here. When we're thinking about all of this, where do you see people starting in your work? I know you work with a lot of companies maybe who haven't had much IT experience necessarily. So how do you bring that compute, storage, and networking together into one cohesive strategy when it is so widely, when actually the options are so great and, you know, and can be so widely distributed?
Sure. Yeah, I kind of have this little 7 golden rules thing that I've developed over time, right? And the first thing that I tell people is to stand still and take stock. You know, assess the current state of your legacy systems. And legacy software, you know, that phrase is not a dirty phrase. Old, it doesn't have to be old or outdated to be legacy. It's just assess where you are with your legacy environment, right? And think about the issues that can happen and think about where you're at. And then the second thing I tell them is to select a modernization approach that's going to be the fastest to deliver value. And we were talking about that a little bit earlier, you know, delivering value to the business, right? I promise you that if you're just starting on your journey to the cloud, it's going to take you longer than you think. You know, you may have some timelines baked out. It's going to be longer. So think about what's going to get you there fastest. I think that as a younger engineer, one of the things we talk about is keep it simple. And there's some chat going back and forth. Rethink the architecture and prioritize for simplicity. That's the next thing that I would tell you. The fourth thing is choose the technology stack that's going to deliver optimal performance and user experience. Sean was talking about that earlier. You know, what's going to be the easiest thing for the users to get their arms around? What's going to matter to the users? What's the outcome going to be? Think about what your future state is going to be, right? Create a separate support and retirement schedule for your legacy systems. And then think about budget for training and systems updates. Those are my sort of 7 golden rules as you're sort of looking through this and thinking through it, because it can feel really daunting. Take the applications that I think Dermaine was mentioning, you know, take the applications that are mission critical to you when you start. And that's what you want to start your application rationalization with, right? Think about what really matters to the business and how can you align best with the business.
Mm-hmm. Would anyone like to follow up on that, kind of some of those concepts? Sean, any thoughts from the end user perspective? Because you must see people going through this kind of journey all the time.
Yeah, I think in the end user front, there's a lot of, there's actually a very significant amount of legacy, you know, as Joe was calling out. And, you know, one of the worst things I think I hear when we get engaged with the customer is they make a comment of, well, this is how it was always done. So we're just going to do it this way because this is what we've always done. I actually look back to circumstances like the pandemic that happened, and obviously it's a difficult topic for a lot of people because it upended a lot of things about the way we work. But you know, the old adage of never let a crisis go to waste, it was a great opportunity for organizations to say, hey, we can't keep doing things the way we've done them before because it does not enable our employees to be productive. It doesn't allow them to work on the devices they want to work on and use applications the way they want to use them. So when you have opportunities like that you're facing where you have to make a decision to re-architect something almost overnight, you know, on the fly, it's a great opportunity to use that particular circumstance to say, okay, now we have the opportunity, meaning the budget and the authorization, to go start paving this on the right path. So always look for those opportunities to kind of flip the switch and say, how can we now accelerate this thing that we've been wanting to modernize for a long, long time? And now we've got a very legitimate business reason to make this investment and then just go get it done.
So I want to pile on a little bit. First of all, I love that Joe has like the 7, because I love lists. So who doesn't? But you know, one that also jumped out at me that I think deserves a lot attention and gets overlooked is that investment in training right? And how do you budget, whether it's time or actual, you know, dollars and resources for how do you upskill people? And in just this morning, the Wall Street Journal was writing about how there's just this explosion in demand for cloud jobs, right? Like who skilled workers, you know, this is, and it's been accelerated by the pandemic, but this kind of skills gap that is constantly in the way, and particularly with what's going on now, the great resignation and really remembering that like people are a big part of your strategy. And so how are you investing in upskilling your current employee base? And that's really going to help them with their goals. It's going to keep them engaged, and it's going to help you achieve those technology goals. So I love that that's one of the seven on Joe's list. And I think realizing that folks learn in all kinds of different ways. What I hear when I talk to folks at that practitioner level in particular, I like poking around where folks have moved from having more of like an infrastructure centric background into becoming more of a platform engineer, right? And more of a DevOps engineer where they're interfacing a lot more with their developers. And they're, as a result, they're not kind of sitting behind a ticketing system. They're really engaging much more closely with the apps that are driving the business and how to support the platform that's supporting those apps. But the thing that I hear when I talk to those folks is, like, you really have to get hands-on and learn new things. You got to learn about using Git repositories and sort of all the GitOps the catchphrase that it's become. You need a chance to actually do that, right? Get familiar with what that process looks like. And things like, you know, get comfortable with CI/CD tooling and what those pipelines are going to look like. And then, of course, like as folks are ramping up and learning about Kubernetes itself, like this is a big part of the announcement we made this week with Tanzu Community Edition, right? It's a free upstream version. Just play around with it. But if you don't pair that with the executive and leadership culture, to come back to our question earlier about innovation, if you don't have that culture, all the free software in the world isn't going to solve that, right? You've got to make it okay for people to take time to go learn and educate themselves, and that will pay dividends. But I just want to really plus one that point on Joe's list. And we'll step off my soapbox now.
No, it's a good point. And one of the questions that I keep thinking about too, then, is about security and how you think about security in all of this. I really like the post that Dormain told us about by Kate Colbert, who is the CTO at VMware. And he wrote a story about how you have to think about this concept of modern least privilege. And I really like this article. And I was thinking about, like, you know, all the things you read about, like good hygiene and security, reminds me of a really good restaurant. When you walk in the door, it's, you know, the sidewalk out front is clean. You know, you go inside and the tables are just right. And, you know, and the glassware is beautiful and everything else. And that really extends all the way to the back of the kitchen, you know, or the equipment is beautiful. There's, you know, there's just a sound team there. And it makes me think about kind of these really core principles that you have to think about when you're building out cloud native architectures. You know, it's, you have to focus on the immutable infrastructure, the ephemeral environments, the automation, the shift left principles, to really focus on that developer experience. But one thing he said in particular was repair, repave, and rotate. And this reminds you kind of a little bit about what Lawrence was bringing up in his question for us, because he was talking about, you know, this idea of deploying code. But how do you remediate these fixes, you know, when you're thinking about distributed infrastructure? How do you think about code updates? And I guess it comes back a bit, Dormain, to GitOps, you know, workflows and processes and stuff. But Joe, this seems like quite a lot for companies to try to understand. And maybe then, Mandy, you could provide your perspective too.
Sure. So I think that, and something that Mandy said earlier was spot on, when you're dealing in a multi-cloud environment, there is this massive learning curve. Every cloud is different, right? Everyone has they do a good job and they're built on five pillars, and the cloud providers do a good job of providing information, but taking in that information and really sort of thinking through it and how it applies in your environment, especially if you're a small team, is tough. And so the Nirvana is a platform and a set of tools that will let you make that management easier, right? That's the holy grail of things. And I think that VMware is really working towards that and has worked out some of those bugs. And imagine being able to come onto a platform that you already know and you trust and you understand, and you can just get in there and work. You don't have to necessarily understand the nuances of each cloud provider. That's really the thing that you're looking to do, because you're not looking to become an expert in their cloud. You're looking to bring value to your business. Mandy, what do you think?
Well, I completely agree. And I liked Kit's article as well. And there were a lot of good points in there. And the repair, repave, is it recycle? I can't remember, are good practices. But ultimately, you know, he started out by talking about the new world of least privilege. And least privilege is critical, of course, because as everything is now connected, you know, over the internet, and as all kinds of capabilities and functionality are now available through public APIs, making sure that not only users are authorized, but also other systems becomes a critical core part of any application. And so whether you do that at the application level, or whether you build that into the platform itself, or whether you do it, you know, throughout the stack, it's something that has to be top of mind when developing the application and building the platform, as well as, because in the past, you know, we've always kind of bolted it on afterwards, or security has been a different team. And that's where these discussions around DevSecOps have come from, around, you know, shifting left some of that functionality earlier in the process so that developers can deal with it. But I think that, you know, I thought of something the other day that kind of made me smile. And it was my mum had driven around a corner in a car and the door came open and my sister nearly fell out. That's not what made me smile. But my grandma grabbed a hold of her and pulled her in. And so then forevermore, there weren't seatbelts in the back at that point, but then forevermore it was you locked your door before we drove off. And now, you know, that's just in the car itself. There isn't a car that's sold today that you don't drive off and the doors all lock themselves, right? And so we have to become the same across technology, is that we have to stop putting the onus on the developer or the administrator or the platform team to create and enforce the security and just make sure that it is intrinsic all the way through the stack.
Wow, that must have been a traumatic event in your childhood. I mean,
I'm
falling
not sure
out
it
of
was.
A car.
I don't know why I thought about it the other day, but yeah, it was very interesting. But there was no safety back there, right? Back then, right? There was, you know, all of us were piled on the back seat. There's no such thing as a safety belt. Yeah, very different.
Yeah,
world. I'm not that old. I like to think I'm not that old.
Well, but, I mean,
yeah.
I fell out of my dad's Chevy station wagon back door once, and like I was like seven or something,
yeah.
And I was like, "Where am I?" You know?
Did he stop for you?
A few years later, yeah, he did.
Wait a minute, where's Alex?
there has to be some analogy here, some to a metaphor to what we're talking about. But I think you hit on it, Mandy. One thing I would like to ask Sean is, you know, how are end users trying to, how are they struggling with this? Because they've been so focused on the perimeter for so long.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the concept of zero trust in and of itself is not a new concept. It dates back to the early 2000s, came out of a CISO security forum named Jericho Forum. And there are multiple different tenets of zero trust. One of them is least privilege access, as we've kind of already been talking about here. One of them is the idea of deperimeterization, the idea that we can't keep all the apps and data in the data center and keep this great firewall around it, because all attackers are going to do is find the weakest link in, and then inside it's all Swiss cheese. So the idea is that we need to start building sort of mini perimeters around any type of asset or resource and make sure that we have controlled enforcement mechanisms. So I'll take the access scenario of an end user who wants to use an application in the data center or an end user that wants to use a SaaS application from the cloud. We need to have ways of verifying that the user is who they say they are. In other words, validating the identity of the user, validating that they have authorization to use that application, and then grant them the least possible privilege in order to access that. So when we talk about things like network access, the historical legacy model is give everyone a device-based VPN tunnel. They can VPN at the data center and get access to all the things they need. That's a non-least privileged form of network access because they can not only talk to their application server, they can talk to everything else, including other PCs, routers, servers, everything in the data center. So to make that a more least privileged style model, we would create a micro tunnel or a tunnel of one, so to speak, between the user and the application where they can only talk to one another, like a micro segment of one. This idea of segmenting the network, segmenting the privilege access, all that kind of stuff, that's what Zero Trust is really all about. Now, the difficulty is as applications are moving from the data center out to the public cloud, we don't always have the same security controls inside the data center out into the public cloud. So what some organizations do is VPN their users into the data center, apply all their layered security controls so they've got visibility in what the user is doing, tracking the behavior, all that kind of stuff. But the problem is now you've created artificial hops or latency of the user communication through the data center, then back out to the cloud. So that results in inefficient user experience. So what we've done at VMware is introduce something called SASE, Secure Access Services Edge. This is an industry standard term created by Gartner that basically talks about taking your security technologies that you used to deploy in the data center, things like firewalls and IDS and URL inspection and all those types of things, and moving them out to the edge so that you put them kind of in line between the user and the asset or resource, and you don't have to hairpin that traffic back through the data center, which kind of degrades the user experience. So, you know, Zero Trust at Network Access is all about changing the security model, making it identity-centric, making sure there's trust from the devices, the identity, things like multi-factor authentication. And by the way, this extends all the way back to the applications as well, because you can take things like behaviors of users and apply the same concepts to things like API calls. Whether you're going through a traditional API gateway or a more modern service mesh approach, you can look at behaviors of API calls as an input as to whether or not something seems anomalous about the behavior and use that to establish trust or credibility in that call.
So, Sean, you're really talking about an end-to-end approach, which I love, right? Because, you know, now it's a seamless experience, both for, you know, back to Mandy's point, it's everything is on the poor network guy, right? Or the IT team to make sure that everything's shored up. And wouldn't it be great to have a tool that and a platform that sort of secures things all along the way, all along the journey, so that you're getting that really layered approach to everything, but it's a little bit more seamless. You're not dealing with multiple tool sets.
Yeah, and Joel, I'll just add one more thing to kind of re-highlight a couple of the things we talked about before. You know, I heard hygiene mentioned earlier today. You know, without a doubt, proper hygiene, whether we're talking about modern apps or cloud infrastructure or endpoint devices, proper hygiene stops literally 90% of the attacks out there, honestly. Like, if you do the bare minimum on hygiene, you can stop most of the attacks that are out there. The other thing that I would say is that comment we talked about earlier, that idea of repaving and immutability, one of the most important things that you can do to prevent a successful attack is to eliminate the dwell time. Dwell time basically refers to when an attacker breaches your environment and they're allowed to sit there for months on end. So anything that you can do to make infrastructure components immutable, meaning they get recreated every single time you provision the resource, and it doesn't exist longer than a few seconds or a few minutes or a few hours or a few days, that means that even the most skilled attackers out there that are able to compromise one of your systems, because it's destroyed minutes or hours later, does not give them much of a chance to spread throughout the network and try to compromise other resources. So that idea of repaving an immutable infrastructure is so key in trying to prevent attacks.
I would just love to hear from Mandy and Dermaine, maybe just to sum up, you know, what your thoughts are on how we're thinking about this from VMware's perspective going forward. if you could just take a minute each, it'd be really helpful, I think, for all of us.
What Sean put together there, like, was awesome. And his points particular about, hey, this is like, once someone gets through and everything's like Swiss cheese, like that's where you're going to have problems. So to the point about hygiene, it's like, we practice hygiene, like washing our hands, not because we already know we have a virus or a bacterial infection. We do it so that we don't get sick, even if we don't know that it's there yet. So that concept is what applies here. And I also want to give shout out credit for the whole 3 R's, rotate, repair, repave, to Justin Smith, who published on it nearly 5 years ago. And it's really about speed. And it's really about that hygiene and sort of how have you optimized for speed, knowing that as much as all this other work to prevent, you know, attackers from getting in, they are going to get in, you are going to have vulnerabilities. So how have you set up your environment? And immutability is a big part of it, to Sean's point, so that you can kind of blow things away and lay down new infrastructure. And it's not unfair. It's just normal part of just like washing your hands every day. So, you know, banks like Wells Fargo getting to the point where they just roll out updated operating systems, you know, every week, just because, not because there's a vulnerability. And so getting to that point, and that's a big part of what Tanzu does, where it's thinking about that whole container life cycle. So how have you baked in those points of control into that entire life cycle so that you can take advantage of immutable infrastructure, but also use that to just have good hygiene around what's getting packed into your containers in the first place. How are they connecting to other systems in a way that's secure by default, right? With mutual TLS, like just make that the normal so that it's akin to this kind of zero trust, but it's least privilege. But you're treating it everywhere. But it's really for speed.
Yeah, I would agree. It's back to that what we talked about earlier, that is being in that known state, that known non-compromise, no config drift state. But what I would wrap up and say is that if you saw the keynote at VMworld with Raghu talking about the phases that VMware has been in, he talks very clearly about where VMware is and intends to keep innovating for the future, and that is around multi-cloud. So that whether that is making multi-cloud easier to manage or making multi-cloud more efficient or cost-effective or optimized, or allowing you to avoid the lock-in of the various different providers, or bringing true multi-cloud in terms of the application space and Tanzu and that portfolio, that's our focus. And so even if you're not looking today to really make progress in one of those areas, which I would be surprised if an organization isn't, but that's our focus and has been for a while. So come talk to us. Come talk to us, learn from our experiences. We're a software development company, right? And have been since inception. We're also in 80% of the workloads in any enterprise is on the VMware platform. So we know enterprises, and now we know multi-cloud, and we're kind of a cloud agnostic provider in that sense, because we work across all of them. So if you take nothing else away from this discussion today, take away that we're here to help you with your transformation, and we can support you whatever your cloud strategy or your application strategy is.
Great. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us. Job Jackson, editor in chief, thank you so much for being a co-host, Job. I know Job has to run, so he may have to take off. Mandy Sorbakken with VMware Cloud Technologies, Sean Bass, CTO for VMware's End User Computing Business, and Joe Peterson, Vice President Cloud and Security Services at Clarity 360. Thank you so much for joining us for some pancakes and a nice discussion on multi-cloud. Thank you very much.
VMware software powers today's complex digital infrastructures. Their cloud, networking and security, and digital workspace offerings provide dynamic and efficient solutions to over 500,000 global customers. VMware is committed to being a force for good, from its breakthrough innovations to its global impact.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe on Simplecast to listen to more episodes on the new SAC Makers. Create and share your favorite audiogram using our Simplecast player. For more articles and great stories, go to thenewstack.io.